wish you had a better job? Want to be happier on your current job? Don't even have a job? Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
America is scared. Scared of India. Scared of China. Taking what we call our jobs. All those smart people working for far less. Now, according to my guest, even our one ostensible advantage, the entrepreneurial spirit, out-of-the-box thinking, choose your metaphor, or cliche, rather, is a disappearing advantage. Indeed, my guest points out that 52% of Silicon Valley startups have been started by highly skilled immigrants. And in recent years, ever more of those highly skilled immigrants come to the U.S. only for their degree, typically from Stanford, Berkeley, Harvard, the usual suspects. And then they go back to their home country to use their knowledge to start businesses in their home countries, businesses designed to compete with the best American companies, which thereby, of course, would result in yet fewer U.S. jobs. Well, everyone on both sides of the aisle agree that the best way to create permanent jobs in the U.S., permanent jobs at least, is entrepreneurship, starting new businesses. Well, here in the studio to talk about what lessons we as individuals and as a country can learn from this new wave of entrepreneurs is a guy I just met but really liked in the 3 minutes. And I think you're really going to like him when you hear why I like him. I'll let him explain it himself. But anyway, his name is Vivek Wadhwa. He himself is an immigrant from India. Started two companies, successful companies. Had their issues like most companies, but certainly a smart, successful guy. And he's gone on to his current positions as Director of Research on Entrepreneurship at Duke, Senior Research Associate on Labor and Work Life at Harvard Law School, and Visiting Scholar at UC Berkeley. This month, a couple weeks ago, he testified before Congress on how America can survive this latest challenge to U.S. jobs. Vivek Wadhwa, welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Marty, thanks for having me here.
My pleasure. Speak a little closer to the mic.
Sure, absolutely.
I did not expect to be asking you this, but while we were waiting before the show, you told me something about yourself personally that makes, for me, infinitely more credible everything you're going to say for the rest of the show. Tell us about it, please.
Marty, we were talking about how us old guys need to look after our health, and you asked me why I was doing what I'm doing. Why do I care so much about America? And my answer was that I've been there, done it, and at this stage of my life, it's all about giving back. Why is that the case? Because when I was 45, which is about 8 years ago, I had a massive heart attack. And before that, I had built two companies. I was obsessed, like most of my friends in Silicon Valley are, with building successful businesses, taking my company public, $1 billion in market cap and so on. I was just like all my friends are, except I broke. Second company gone into trouble, I fixed it, and then I had a massive heart attack. When I woke up in the hospital, it was like the Twilight Zone. I thought I was indestructible. Because nothing could go wrong. I could fix everything except myself. And I ended up in hospital, and the doctor said if I didn't check in the next 2 hours, I wouldn't have checked out. So when you go through an experience like that, you reconsider life's priorities. You try to figure out, well, why am I here? What can I do? And for me, it was trying to do as much good as I could while I was still alive. Now, it's been a long time, and I'm feeling strong and healthy again. So I'm able to do a lot, accomplish a lot. But the fact is I've never gone back to that world. It's all about giving back to the world. And America has done so much for me. The reason why I'm so successful, the reason why I'm here with you, the reason I have all these opportunities is because of this great country. It accepted me, it embraced me, it allowed me to achieve my potential and give back to it. So this is why I do it, because I can give back to it now. This is why I teach, this is why I preach, this is why I research, because I can.
My dear listeners, we're going to talk about a lot of specifics about jobs and entrepreneurship, but my intuition says that there will be nothing that will be said in this half hour of greater value than what is said before you have your heart attack or after you have, or you have cancer or whatever you have, whether you're 20 or you're 80. realize that materialism is ultimately shallow, that you would be wiser, and I swear to you, I am not just talking the talk. I would walk. I have money. But if I had no money, I would rather live in a hovel and try to make a difference than be rich and just forget about making the biggest difference I can in the world. I think there can be no more important message that we could live with you. Would you agree with that, or is that a little bit too extreme?
Absolutely. I mean, in fact, anyone who is mid-aged who's listening should go and get a stress test, because I thought I was indestructible, literally, that I was never sick, never been to the doctor, I didn't even have a doctor, and suddenly I'm having shooting pains in my left arm. I mean, where did this come from? It came from stress. My cholesterol was low. Everything was fine, except it came out of the blue. So you never know. I mean, you can make your $1 billion and then live, you know, drop dead the next day, or be in bad health, or, you know, life changes. Life makes its own plan. So the best thing is to give back and do all the good you can while you can.
Yeah, and I'm certainly no medical doctor, but while a stress test may be right for some people, I certainly don't want to be, neither of us want to be offering medical advice here, but it's certainly, we are on safe ground to say, keep a sense of perspective. Yes, work hard, but not stressed. Keep a sense of perspective that you have only so much power. You want to make a difference, but you don't want to drive yourself crazy making a difference. Yes, eat a largely plant-based diet. Do exercise moderately. You don't need to be a marathoner. If you do those kind of things, then you will probably have set in motion the things you need to do to stay healthy. Because we all know that too often, even the medical establishment, as good as they can be, there's also a lot of medical errors, a lot of unnecessary testing. The best, as they say, the best prevention, the best cure, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. So take care of yourself so you don't need to get into the medical system. Okay, now let's turn back to what we were originally going to talk about, which is entrepreneurship, lessons for us as individuals and for America as a society. In your testimony before Congress, a couple weeks, was it October 5th, just a couple, 10 days ago, you asserted that, quote, the U.S. no longer possesses the advantage on entrepreneurship that some believe it does. What's your evidence of that?
Well, first of all, anecdotal, that I've traveled extensively to India and China and to other parts of the world, and noticed over the last few years, last 5 or 6 years as an academic, a distinct change in the next generation. Take China and India. It used to be that failure was not tolerated culturally, starting companies.
What was not tolerated?
Failure.
I'm sorry.
Basically, yeah. What would happen is if you failed, then it would be a stigma on your family. Your parents couldn't hold their head up high socially.
Interesting.
And your parents would basically beg you not to start a company.
Wow.
In case you failed. That's how it used to be.
Wow.
Go there today and meet the youth in the big cities, and they are just like the youth here in Silicon Valley, that they're all talking about what they're going to start. Their parents are supportive. Their parents are accepting, not supportive. It's not to the point that they're saying, hey, you know, drop out of school, accept Peter Thiel's $100,000. And don't do that. I mean.
Yeah. That implies that the entrepreneurship is a relatively new phenomenon in India and China. So are there really any lessons that we as Americans can learn from this new breed of entrepreneurs from India and China?
Well, entrepreneurship is a broad topic. Entrepreneurship is as old as the hills, and I would argue that India and China have been more entrepreneurial historically than America ever has been, that they take more risks. The person who sells samosas on the street is an entrepreneur.
Samosa, by the way, mashed potato stuff with a wrapping. Also, not a heart attack on a plate. Continue.
Exactly. So there are a lot of entrepreneurs, but I'm talking about youth entrepreneurs, Silicon Valley-style entrepreneurship. Because here in Silicon Valley, there's one thing we have to worry about. It's all these, you know, millions of children in India and China becoming like us, learning our ways, developing our skills, and then eating our lunch. Yeah. And I tell you, that's the way the world is headed right now.
Is, you know, you say they become risk takers. I never forget a conversation I had with a venture capitalist. I don't remember who it was anymore. It may have been Ann Winblad, who said that that venture capitalists actually don't take risks.
No, VCs don't take risks.
They control risk.
Oh, yeah.
So is it not correct, and indeed in my career counseling practice, I'm always teaching people how to keep their, you know, how to maximize the profit with minimizing risk. How much is risk-taking, in your judgment, critical to the successful entrepreneur?
It is, because starting a company, you know, if you're graduating from IIT in India, mm-hmm. or Fudan University or Tsinghua University in China.
These are the most prestigious universities in India and China.
Exactly. They are Howard and MIT.
The Harvard of India.
You have more job offers than you do if you graduate from Stanford. Okay. Now, you can be making the equivalent of $100,000 a year here, or you can be starving and making zero and starting a company. That's very risky.
Right? I guess so.
So why would they do it? They're for the same reasons that our students here do it.
Let me push back just a little bit. You know, we hear, and today there's no more job security. You can be working for Hewlett-Packard or Apple or whatever and be downsized tomorrow. Your whole office could be sent to India, or your boss doesn't like you, or your skill set is not quite the, you know, you don't know Python and they really want you to know Python rather than Perl. So really there is no job security in being employed. Where isn't where you start your own company, if you indeed, you do sweat the details, you are smart, you are hardworking, you bring the right team and you talk to your customers, you do all those things, don't you really have far more job security and far more income potential? Even if one business loses over your lifetime, you make one win out of four, you've made enough money from the one. So really, when you really add the whole calculus, is it not true that it's if you're smart and driven, that it's actually less risky to be self-employed than to be employed?
Mary, you've got the glamorous version of entrepreneurship here. I'm afraid most startups, you know, 90% plus of them fail. In fact, if you're a graduate from a university, the likelihood is 99% that your startup will fail.
Wow.
So and you're going to lose your shirt, you're going to lose a lot of money on it, and you're going to grow up. But you know, after you do it two or three or four times, the likelihood of success becomes greater. You become smarter. And this is the magic of Silicon Valley, that we understand that, we encourage it here. Nowhere else in the world do we have these conversations about, hey, failing is okay. It's a badge of honor. Every time you fail, you get smarter. In other places of the world, when you fail, you now have a stigma. Even in Europe, if you fail, you're now, you know, this failed entrepreneur. People look down at you.
I listened to your wording very carefully. You said, if you graduated from a university, the chances are 99% of you fail, and you only get to have higher odds when you've learned on your own skin and done three or four business. Isn't that an enormous indictment of university training?
No, it's nothing to do with universities. Even if you went to the best trade school, you'd still have that. That's the way it goes in entrepreneurship. It's a learning exercise. You have to learn the basics of how do you understand markets, how do you position yourself, how do you motivate people, how do you manage finances. It takes a few times to get that right. But the biggest risk over here, and this is a Silicon Valley thing, is that we're pioneering into new domains. Social media until 2 or 3 years ago was a new domain. So there was no business model for that. So you have an idea which you think might make an impact, you test it out. And it's never been done before. You can't teach that, because this is rapidly evolving technology.
You're listening to Work with Marty Nemco. My very special guest is Vivek Wadhwa. He is, I don't know how to describe him, he's a combination academic entrepreneur, but very respected, knows a lot about entrepreneurship in India and China. I'm wondering whether, in fact, this whole notion of innovation is the problem. One of the things I teach my clients is don't innovate, replicate. Only big companies can afford to innovate because of the long odds of the brand new idea that hasn't been yet thought of by the 7 billion people on the planet in the time of history. The odds of that being a winner is small, especially if you're not extremely well capitalized and can endure the early losses. So isn't it wiser for the average person listening to this show who want to be self-employed, rather than to innovate, replicate some proven formula and do it in either a different geographic area or simply find a product that could stand some improvement in execution?
Marty, I would partly agree with you, but I would use different words. I would say learning from other people's successes, learning from other people's failures. That even though you're building another Twitter, for example, you can come up with new ways of implementing it, customize it to different regions, and still be innovative. So this is what the Chinese do. The Chinese aren't innovative in the way we are in Silicon Valley. They don't shatter the world, but what they're doing is incremental innovation. They're stealing our ideas and then customizing them and making them work in a different environment. So there is innovation in that, but not the way not what we would call innovation.
And from what you say, that's pretty smart, because if it's too bold an innovation, the risk of failure is so great. So the Chinese are being very smart in making some more incremental improvements that have a much higher probability of success. Should we be taking? Is that one of the lessons we should be taking from the Chinese, rather than ridiculing them for not being innovative enough?
Well, we need to do both, because if you keep doing more of the same, you don't change the world.
I understand that, right. But from an individual, from a societal standpoint, I understand, let those 99 out of 100 fail, because the country is better for the one bold innovation. But from the individual standpoint, wouldn't they be wiser to not be the guinea pig and the sacrificial lamb?
It's a safer strategy to try to replicate someone else's model. But I'm for bold strategies. I also teach at Singularity University here on NASA's campus. Singularity is just blow away. What we teach at Singularity is exponential technologies that are going to change the world.
Right.
If you now study those technologies, if you look at the convergence of DNA, computing, robotics, AI, big data, and all of the things that are happening, you can now look 3 or 4 or 5 years ahead and realize that these are going to build the next $1 billion businesses. Social media is yesterday's news. It's
right.
Within a year, we're going to be looking back at it.
I feel that too. Good.
So now, what's the next big thing? Well, this is the stuff we do at Singularity University.
Right. Okay. So my intuition is that that's right, that social media has already become a mature industry and it's going to have limitations. Yes, we do rely on our friends' advice for what we buy, but it feels like that's being oversold. That's my very simplistic analysis. What's your analysis of why it's yesterday's news?
Because it's already big. I mean, we already have our Facebooks and Twitters. Now you'll have different permutations of it. You'll have new technologies. You know, for example, the new Apple iPhone with voice recognition.
Right.
Well, now guess what? Voice recognition is going to become normal. What if we can now integrate voice recognition with social media?
Makes sense.
There might be some great startups there. I don't know. I'm just sort of...
It's a good idea. Yeah. Clearly, that's one of those nice incremental improvements. Who wants to type? Everybody's error-prone in typing, but if voice recognition, you know, gets better and better so that it has fewer errors, you can see it would be embedded in every device that used to have a keyboard.
Exactly.
I want to... Singularity, for those of you who don't know, so the word singularity means the moment in time, I think it was coined by Ray Kurzweil, who said that when computers will be as smart as humans. Is that correct?
Exactly.
Okay. So I want to propose, for our conversation, that, again, giving my listeners either practical ideas for career directions they want to pursue if they want to be innovators or simply because it's interesting. It strikes me that the two areas that are most likely to yield true breakthroughs is in the individual genomics area.
Yes.
They've been talking about it for 20 or 30 years, but I really believe that as computing power increases, that in fact we are going to reach the day where that heart attack that you had at 45 could have been easily predicted with more sophisticated tests than a cardio-CRP or a stress test. And that all physicians will be much more computer-guided by artificial intelligence. Do you agree with that?
Absolutely, 100%. You know, the genome was only sequenced a decade ago.
Right, 2001.
It cost us about $1 billion, a gazillion dollars to sequence it the first time.
Right.
Now, genome sequencing, full DNA sequencing, costs about $10,000. Within 3 years, 4 years, 5 years, it'll be to the point that you get it free when you buy a subscription. In other words, the cost is going to drop to zero. But think of it. Now we can we have all this genome data that was unimaginable before. If our techies wanted to start solving new problems, they could try finding out what strands of DNA are common, what genes are common, what impact do they have, matching them up with the health results that are becoming publicly available, and come up with amazing new applications which change the world.
I want to paraphrase that back down. People kind of intuitively feel, oh, great, we sequenced the genome. That doesn't mean anything. That's really, all it is like laying out what the roadmap is. It doesn't say what all the cities are in that roadmap and what they do. Which cluster of, we know where they are on the genome, where these genes are, big deal. What really matters is which cluster of those genes are causal for which kinds of cancer, which are causal for what kinds of depression, which are causal for what kinds of intelligence. And once we do that, that's the deal changer, because that creates drug therapies or other kind of therapies that can cure and prevent disease.
Imagine being able to add friends on Facebook or the next Facebook, whatever it might be, based on your DNA. That you find people who have similar characteristics to you, who have similar intelligence, who have similar diseases, whatever it might be. Now, that would be a blow your socks off application that can be built now and ready for the time when genome testing costs close to zero.
Of course, I do not want to imply, and I'm sure you're not trying to imply, that everything is genetic. We are partly a function of our
Absolutely.
Environment as well
Absolutely.
As our genes and the interaction thereof. Let's turn to one of your special areas of expertise, which is engineering careers. Indeed, you are executive in residence at Duke School of Engineering, and you wrote this very interesting quote. It's a long quote, but good enough that I'm going to take the 1 minute or so it takes to read it. Quote, "The harsh reality is that in the tech world, companies prefer to hire young, inexperienced engineers. And engineering is an up or out profession. You either move up the ladder or face unemployment. That is not something that tech executives publicly admit because they fear being sued for age discrimination. But everyone knows that that is the way things are." He continues to quote, I'm continuing to read the quote. "Why would any company hire a computer programmer with the wrong skills for a salary of $150,000 when it can hire a fresh graduate with no skills for about $60,000? Even if it spends a month training the younger worker, the company is still far ahead. The young understand new technologies better than the old do and are a clean slate. They will rapidly learn the latest coding methods and techniques, and they don't carry any so-called technology baggage. As well, the older worker likely has a family and needs to leave by 6 p.m., whereas the young can pull all-nighters, end quote. So,
That's brutal, isn't it, Marty? But that's the reality. Everyone knows it is. Not to say that there aren't some really skilled, very valuable older workers who are very, you know, worthwhile to the companies. There are, but they're the minority. The majority, you know, are not the way I'm describing. And that's a harsh. It breaks my heart when I see that. But whether I like it or whether you like it or not, that is how it is.
And so the million-dollar question is, so what is a 30-something engineer or a 40-something? Or, you know, we are both, we're about the same age. We're late in our 50s or early 60s or something like that.
Early 50s, me.
Yeah, I'm a little older. And so what is a, you know, I'll say I'm 61. And I have as much energy and
You're an old guy.
Yeah, I'm an old guy, but I feel I got another 20 or 30 years left if I can keep my stress down. What advice do you have for the engineer or other person who's 51 or 61 and still is certainly far from out to pasture?
First of all, realize the fact that that if you get laid off, it's going to be very hard to find a job.
I know. Clients are finding it very tough.
Keep your skills current. Try to move up the ladder. Learn management. Maybe you start your own company. You're in Silicon Valley. You know, this is another important point, that starting companies, old guys rule. That the average age of a tech entrepreneur who starts a company in America is 39. Okay, there are twice as many over 60 as there are under 20. Hmm. Twice as many over 50 as under 25. Yet we assume that they're the college dropouts or the Stanford kids. They're not. The average guy, the average tech entrepreneur is more like you and me than the college dropout from Stanford. So the huge opportunities in Silicon Valley to now take all the experience you have and change the world.
You're listening to Work with Marty Nemco. My guest is Vivek Wadhwa. He is I don't know. How do you like to call yourself?
I'm a tech entrepreneur who became an academic.
Yeah. With positions at Duke and at Harvard and at Berkeley, all currently.
Don't forget my plug for the Washington Post, my friend.
That's right.
You're going to be writing with the Washington Post also, I hear.
We both do. We write for the innovation section of the Washington Post.
Say hi to Emmy while you're at it.
I will. Emmy is, I'm glad to hear you say she's great. That's terrific.
Right.
Okay. Because we've just had a couple of brief interactions. She did sound fine. But anyway, right. It doesn't matter. Okay. I'm worried about our conversation being too elitist. I listen to, there is these 7,000 people listening to this show now, roughly, who, some of whom are indeed these smart entrepreneurial ones who keep their skills up, and whether they're 30 or they're 60, they're really go-getters. But the reality is not everybody is like that. What honest advice, and the one thing I know I can count on you is to be honest, what honest advice do you have for more average people, let alone the 50% that by definition are below average in intelligence, below average in drive, below average in technical skills, and below average in emotional resilience, which is very important?
Marty, I'm going to get a lot of hate mail for this, but I'm going to tell it the way it is. What you have to expect is that your salary is going to drop. That you, first of all, you have to keep your skills current. Learn Python, learn whatever there is. Secondly, just because you're making $150,000 a year, $90 an hour, don't expect that you have the right to make that. You maybe end up making $90,000 a year and still get a good job. Like I said, I'm going to have people hating me for saying it, but that is the harsh reality.
I want to be even tougher. I have so many people who call into this show who fit a very different profile.
Right.
They may or may not have finished college. They may have 3 years of college in sociology, in American studies, in art, in psychology. They care tremendously about family, about work-life balance. They're artists. They're creative. They're not emotionally resilient. When bad things happen, they get depressed. They're nice people. They're not stupid. They're normal people. What I've just described defines millions and millions of good folks. If I were your brother and that defined me, I'm not going to learn Python. I'm not going to get hired in Python. I'm not going to make $70,000 or $80,000 a year. I need to survive and make $30,000 a year. What advice do you have for me?
It's still about skills and training. I tell you, you have to. There are professions which do pay well. You can become a radiologist. You can become a mid-level manager. I mean, there are many, many, many different professions.
Radiologist and MD. You mean a radiologic technician.
Technician. There are many, you know, professions which are somewhere in between, and you have to basically learn those new professions. There's so much information available on the internet right now about what the professions are, what the opportunities are. You know, you can go to Berkeley and do a degree in paralegal studies, for example, and start up making $60,000 with a one-year degree. And so that's what normal human beings can do. That's just one weird example. But the point is that there are many professions like that where you can still make decent salaries. Decent salaries, I mean, you know, $60,000, $70,000, $80,000 are decent salaries, and still, you know, support yourself.
You wrote a column in the Washington Post that we just discussed. Yeah. I love the title. Mr. President, there is no engineering shortage. Your main point seems to be that except for a few brilliant, out-of-the-box thinking, innovative engineers that probably do need to be hired locally, there are more than enough engineers in India and China who will work for pennies on the dollar compared with U.S. workers. So why should we, as the U.S. government, we continue to exhort more people to go in engineering? It's a long, hard major. And after that, unless they're a star, in which case they'd probably already made major in engineering, face unemployment. Why should we dig deeper into the barrel?
Because engineers still make more than other professions do. That it's not only engineering which is up or out. It's many professions that are like that. It's still, I mean, if you're above average, you can still make a ton of money in engineering.
But what I'm saying is the exhortation for more people to go in engineering means we're going to go deeper into the barrel. So these are not going to be the above average.
Marty, why do you think I've been ripping into our president for hyping the engineering shortage? There's no shortage of engineers. We're competing globally now. Now the second question is, why do I support immigration if there's no shortage of engineers? Because it's not about shortages, it's about competition. Right now we're competing with India, China, Brazil, the rest of the world. India and China are now graduating 1.5 million engineers versus about 150,000 of ours.
Or now, you mean?
The numbers have increased a lot. So their top 10% equal to our entire population. Okay, so what we want is the best and the brightest from all over the world coming and fighting on our team, making the pot bigger. Because ultimately, if you have brilliant people coming here, the pie gets bigger. We create more jobs for the average American.
I know you. I know you make that argument. You know, it's good for America. But isn't that in some ways, even though it's ironic, you're an immigrant? But isn't that in some ways, in some sense, I hate to use the word racist, I care as much about that worker in Calcutta who is poor and living on a dollar a day, and I'd just as soon see the entrepreneur be innovative and create jobs for him or her than somebody in Arkansas or even here in the Bay Area. Why do you care so much about giving America the advantage?
Because I'm now thinking as an American. Yeah, I care about those people also. I want them to do well, but I don't want them to do it well at the cost of American jobs, because I don't want to see people over here unemployed. I want to create more employment over here, and I want to make the world a better place for everyone. So I care about them, but all of the research, all of my writing has been focused on what can America do better? How do we win? How do we fix our economy? How do we create more employment?
We only have a couple of minutes, so I have one more last long question I need to ask you.
Sure.
You participated in a recent debate sponsored by Slate.com. It's going to be airing on PBS, and you took the side that said we should send a yet higher percentage of high school students on to college. Yet you lost. And yet the other side didn't even make what I think is by far the strongest argument. How would you respond to the argument that, according to the U.S. Department of Education, the bottom 200,000 students who we take into college every year have only a 24% of graduating, even if given 8.5 years, and those that defy the odds usually graduate from a third-tier institution with poor grades and a major that doesn't impress many employers, like sociology or art. And meanwhile, the studies, like Academically Adrift, shows that even the graduates learn very, very little, but suffered a constant assault to their self-esteem from inability to learn the material. They spent a fortune they didn't have. They got a mountain of debt and years they could have far more successfully spent, for example, in an entrepreneurship program, in an apprenticeship program.
Marty, because college provides you much more than the technical skills we're talking about. That the fact is that college graduates earn more than non-college graduates.
That's averages. It doesn't apply to those students that digging deeper into the barrel.
No, when you talk about this debt, we assume that we're talking about Stanford graduates with $250,000 of debt. I tell you, getting some college is better than getting no college. If you look at every study that's been done, it shows that for every year you're studying college, your likelihood of long-term employment and revenue goes up.
No, on average. That's one size does not fit all. Of course, that's true on average.
Right.
But an individual who did poorly in high school, who are the ones we are exhorting to go to college now, that student is not going to earn more money. That student will probably not graduate.
You're talking about the outliers, my friend. I mean, you're talking about the people at the bottom. I mean,
that's a big outlier.
I'm talking about the average. I'm talking about the average.
I'm talking about 200,000 a year.
200,000 Stanford graduates.
No, 200,000 people who graduate in the bottom half of their high school class are being exhorted now to go to college.
10 million, maybe. So that's an outlier. We're talking about millions versus the outliers. Yes, some people don't benefit from college, but the vast majority do. This is a fact. You can look at study after study after study. Look at the data. College provides you a huge education. And you know another thing? The worst thing we can do is to disarm now and saying, whoops, college is too expensive. Screw it. We don't need to study college.
I didn't say it's too expensive. Yeah. I said for the right people, even if it's free, the opportunity cost of what
does... But how do you determine who shouldn't go to college?
Who did poorly in high school is the best predictor of who's going to do well in college.
I did poorly in high school. Look at me now. I mean, at five universities, including Harvard, I was not interested in education when I was in high school. I started becoming more interested as I did my bachelor's and master's. But the fact is that you can't, you have to give everyone an opportunity and let them find their own path.
What you described as the outlier. Unless, I hate this, but we have to stop. Vivek Wadhwa, I appreciate very, despite this little debate, which is probably good for our listeners. It's been a pleasure having you
listen
on the
show. Listen to my Peter Thiel debate. You can find that on Google and watch that debate. That gets into this education thing much more than you and I can.
Just Google. The best way to get his stuff is to Google Vivek Wadhwa, and I'm going to spell his name.
Or go to my last name, wadhwa.com, wadhwa.com. You'll find everything there.
Perfect. Okay, thank you very much, Vivek. It was a pleasure.
Thank you, my friend.
Okay, my friend indeed. Okay, and now, David McCulloch is arguably America's greatest biographer. Not only did he win two Pulitzers and two National Book Awards, but he's the recipient of the Presidential Medal of Honor, the highest honor a president can bestow on a civilian. Indeed, Thursday, just last Thursday, former U.S. Ambassador to France Howard Leach introduced McCulloch in his KQED broadcast Commonwealth Club speech as, quote, the greatest living writer. And afterwards he said his talk was, quote, one of the finest ever on the Commonwealth Club. My interview with David McCulloch focused on career lessons from the lives about the people he wrote about. The first half hour of my interview with him aired last Sunday on the show, and here is the second and final. It starts with my asking him about career lessons from Harry Truman's life, including lessons from his decision to drop the bomb on Hiroshima and again on Nagasaki. I want to turn to your biography of Truman, which I find particularly instructive with regard to our own work lives, which is the focus of the show. Arguably, the accomplishment that made Truman electable as president was the so-called Truman Committee. For me, it offers inspiration. All of us in our careers, tell us about the Truman Committee.
Well, the Truman Committee was set up to find and remove and or punish corruption in the war effort. And it was extremely tough and effective, and I would say an astonishing success, due almost entirely to the conscientious and unflappable conduct of Harry Truman.
Yeah.
And when I was working on the book, I tried to interview as many people as I could who either worked with Truman or knew Truman. And I would ask them all several of the same questions. But one of the questions that I asked them all is, when you first heard that Franklin Roosevelt had died and you realized that Harry Truman was president, how did you feel about that? And without exception, now, I stress, these are people who knew him or had worked with him, either in Kansas City or in Washington. Without exception, they all said they felt good. And I said, why? He said, because I knew the man. Mm-hmm. And this is a very important point. They knew the man, not the image of the man, not the voice on the radio or the picture of the man or the idea of the sort of cliche of the little failed haberdasher from the sticks. They knew the man. And what they were talking about was, of course, character. And he showed that without much fanfare and without much glory, superbly, in his role as the chairman of the Truman Committee.
And what you described, you were quite affectionate in your biography of Truman. And the thing that seemed to be the reason for that is because, you know, you're kind of a Midwestern guy. You're from Pittsburgh. You're also understated. You don't like a lot of fanfare and pretense. Your writing is crystalline. It is not lofty. Is that what made him, you know, his, quote, literal and figurative plain-spokenness at the core of his appeal?
I think that had a lot to do with it. He also spoke what he meant. He wasn't glib. He wasn't high-blown. And he never tried to act like anybody else. He never wanted to play a part that wasn't Harry Truman. Mm-hmm. But I think people talk about his courage. He had great courage. There's no question about it. But there are different kinds of courage. What he had, which is the kind you have to have in that job, is the courage of your convictions. And he was a man of very solid convictions. And he had his dislikes. He disliked hypocrisy, but I think that's very American, to dislike hypocrisy. He also he disliked snobbery, intellectual snobbery, any form of snobbery. And he believed in standing with true to your friends. Again, I think that's very American. Sometimes to a detriment, because he would stand by people that hadn't been honest or hadn't been admirable.
Like Boss Prendergast.
Yes, indeed. That's right. And he went to Boss Prendergast's funeral, and
right.
Everybody advised him not to do that.
Right.
And he said, no, you don't do that.
You know, I think you summarize what you're saying. You spoke to a lot of people who knew him, and you quoted somebody as saying, good God, Harry Truman is president? If he can be president, so can my next-door neighbor. He was America's next-door neighbor. Is that
fair?
Yes,
he was. But that wasn't somebody who knew him.
Okay.
That was somebody else.
That was somebody else. Okay.
When the Republicans won the off-year election in 1946 and swept into power in the Congress, and Truman, who had just recently become president, was thoroughly humiliated at the polls. Mm-hmm. He'd gone out to Kansas City to vote, and he and Bess came back by train back to Washington. And you may remember this scene. When he arrived in Washington, the train came into Union Station. There was one person there to meet him.
Mm-hmm.
The President of the United States coming back to Capitol, one person.
Mm-hmm.
And that one person was Dean Acheson. And Truman never forgot that. And the loyalty and the sense of the right thing to do. You go and greet the president when he returns to the capital of our country. And as it turned out, Acheson proved to be one of the greatest secretaries of state we've ever had. Truman knew how to surround himself with good people. He never felt upstaged by those who were better educated or taller or handsomer or wealthier. No, he didn't care. What he wanted was the best people possible working with him to try to achieve something that was the right and best thing for the country.
Of course, that is such a critical aspect of anybody who is in management or leadership, to be willing to have to be secure enough to be inferior to the people you hire. And yet most people don't do it. They will choose people who are loyal.
And to respect people who disagree with you.
Yeah, absolutely.
When Truman wanted to recognize the state of Israel, his then Secretary of State, General Marshall, was absolutely against it. But that didn't change Truman's respect for General Marshall, none whatsoever. He thought Marshall was the greatest American of his time, and in many ways, I think he was right.
You know, unfortunately, so I have heard. You know, I spend most of my life as kind of a career coach to folks, and how often have people, when they speak their mind to the to the higher ups in the corporation, it kills them. It hurts their career. It kills their career.
Yep.
Whistleblowers very often result in having their career devastated. It is easy to say disagree, and it's wise to disagree. In the human condition, is more frail than we would like it to be, alas and alack. I want to, by the way, you said there was one person waiting for Truman at Union Station, but there was a hell of a lot more than one person waiting for him in Independence, Missouri, when he finally left the presidency, wasn't there?
Well, there sure was.
Tell us about that.
And there were a lot of people waiting to vote for him in 1948 who didn't exactly make big, great fanfare about it.
Yeah.
And that, to me, is one of the most wonderful moments in American politics.
But, you know, lest we be too laudatory here. You know, many of us have had to...
I think laudatory is okay now and then. Look, we mustn't dismiss laudatory as being kind of not fair or intelligent.
I didn't know.
There are things that deserve to be praised, that deserve to be admired, and I don't think feel I've been laudatory or overly affectionate about Truman. I think I hope I have admired what he deserves admiration for, and of course you have to always say, as compared to the others who have held the job, how does he measure up against them? And he measures up extremely extremely well.
All right. Well, you said you respect people who disagree with you. Well, I'm going to be tough on you now from disagree, and you tell me if you agree with how you handle my disagreement with you. All right?
Yeah, good.
Well, clearly, Truman made the decision to bomb Hiroshima, and after already seeing the unbelievably devastating effects of it, bomb Nagasaki. I'm going to read you some tidbits from your own book and how one can say that Truman was this wonderful guy that you can't be too positive about. He said, quote, you said, quote, about him, quote, Truman never considered not using the bomb, and after he was exuberant, quote, I have never been happier making an announcement, end quote. You pointed out that of the 150,000 Japanese people who were killed, only 10,000 were soldiers, 140,000 were civilians, quote, people were burned to a cinder while standing up, quote, end quote, and after...
Hold on, 1 second. Press the button, please. Yeah, press the button. Yeah, now turn the knob.
Radio Verite.
All right, I can't do it right now. You'll have to come back in 10 minutes. I'm sorry. Oh, my God, I've got six things going on at once.
Oh,
let's go to your question.
Right, so one more little quote. We're back to...
Truman...
Yeah. Truman did,
He didn't question the decision.
Right.
Nobody questioned the decision at the time. Nobody. Not even Henry Wallace. And if there were some, they were in a decided minority. And we will always, always, and should always question that decision. But I have felt in writing history, you have to put yourself in the place of the people who are involved at the moment. And hindsight is wonderful, and it's great to view these things from the historian's mountaintop. But from examining everything that I was able to put my hands on, it seemed to me that was a fair description of what happened at the moment. Would he have done differently in retrospect? He never said. Was there any second thoughts or feeling of guilt? He never said. We don't know and never will know. And that's, I think, about all we can say for sure.
Okay.
Would I have made that decision then? I have no idea, and I thank God I was never forced to make any decision of that kind. It was a terrible, terrible human loss, but at the same time, it appears by all reasonable judgment that it prevented an even more terrible loss that would have inevitably have resulted had we invaded Japan, which we were indefinitely about to do.
There's no question that big, difficult decisions are critical to all of our career. Each of us usually has one or two things. John Adams, turning to your book, John Adams, he had a critical decision that he made. There was a large peace commission and heavily Quaker that said no independence, there's going to be bloodshed, we are a bunch of ragtags, we're going to have tremendous deaths, we should not declare independence from Britain. And John Adams was probably the leader in the Congress in arguing for a dramatic statement of independence and a war. Tell us about that decision making process that John Adams went through.
Well, Adams really deserves far more credit than he's ever been given, because he is the one who got the bill, the vote to go ahead with a Declaration of Independence,
right,
through the Congress in Philadelphia in July of 1776. The great day that we should be celebrating every year is not July 4th.
Right.
Nothing happened on July 4th,
right,
really. but it's just the date on the document. But it was July 2nd, the day they voted. I want to go back to your earlier questions about Truman and his decisions.
Yeah.
I think that one of the things you have to do in judging a leader, and in particular the American presidency, is to not only judge them by what they did, but what they didn't do. Because leaders have to decide not to do certain things. Mm-hmm. And John Adams decided not to go to war with France in the last part of his first term. And it would have been very popular to have gone to war with France. The opposition party was all for it. The country was angry and roused up. They wanted to go to war with France. And he said no, and it cost him the election. He would have been elected to a second term had he gone to war with France. Eisenhower did not go into Vietnam. These are decisions that have had enormous, long-range historic consequence. And we ought to think more about that when we judge presidencies or presidents.
Yeah, to your point, and here I'm going to agree, you know, you in your book Truman, you also talked about that critical dilemma. Here we're in the Korean War. China had already entered the war when America went above the 38th parallel because of the hubris of MacArthur. And it was an incredibly difficult decision to whether to continue that war or to pull back. And yeah. Truman made the decision to pull back even at the loss of face.
Well, Truman made very many brave decisions. He made his brave, politically brave decision of desegregating the armed services. He made the very courageous and turned out immensely successful decision to proceed with the Berlin airlift with no guarantee that was going to work. Mm-hmm. And of course, there's the Marshall Plan.
Right.
And the recognition of Israel, point four. He did a great deal, and he liked to say that there's no end to what you can accomplish if you don't care who gets the credit, and he was always giving other people credit for things, and most conspicuously the Marshall Plan.
And speaking of the Marshall Plan, to your point in agreement, after he bombed Hiroshima and Nagasaki, his approval rating was 87%. When he pushed the Marshall Plan, which was the biggest expenditure of foreign aid in history, his popularity went down to 32%. He was willing to take a hit and not only not get credit. That is to his credit.
Well, the biggest hit he ever took was firing MacArthur.
Right, right.
They were hanging him in effigy.
Right, MacArthur was the hero, was the big macho hero.
But he knew what he was doing. He was doing the right thing.
Yep.
And of course, we now know, of course, he did the right thing.
Full of hubris. You talked about desegregating the armed forces, but one of the other things I noticed in your books is that you make a point of mentioning that many of the most eminent people you discuss, not just the titular people in your books, but from Thomas Jefferson to the early Harry Truman, had what today would be considered repugnant views about blacks. John Adams, although he never owned slaves, described the participants in the Boston Massacre as mere blacks and mulattoes and Native Americans as, quote, savages and bloodhounds. And like most of the signers
Well, you better be careful about what you say about Adams. Adams is an exemplary figure in his position on slavery and black people, given the times he lived in. He's the only founding father, the only one who never owned a slave out of a matter of principle. And we must not forget that. He and his wife Abigail both felt that slavery was evil and that it was wrong, and they did everything they could to try and compensate against it.
Am I correct that in like almost all of the signers of the Declaration or in the Constitution, that Adams, while he privately held those views, when it came time to the discussions about what was going to go into the Constitution or Declaration, he never spoke out against slavery. Is that correct?
That is correct, but he had nothing to do with the Constitution, nor did Jefferson.
Okay,
but Adams and Jefferson were both in Europe at the time the Constitution was drafted and voted on.
One more example. Even Lincoln, as late as the fourth Lincoln-Douglas debate, said he was convinced that the black race was inferior. As a historian, how do you make sense of so many of our most revered leaders holding such views we find repugnant today?
Yes, but you can also find examples of things that they said and not that just said publicly that would contradict that. They're human beings. They're not perfect. And yes, they can be inconsistent. Yes, they can have bad days. Yes, they can have unattractive prejudices at times, which many of them get over. They change. Mm-hmm. God knows Lincoln changed. I think that things aren't simple.
Mm-hmm.
American history isn't simple.
Mm-hmm.
And people aren't simple. And we have to try and... history is about human beings.
Mm-hmm.
When in the course of human events,
mm-hmm.
and of course they were imperfect, and of course we've had less than stellar people in positions of high responsibility. The exceptional president, the exceptional leader is an exception. And we can't expect every one of them to be terrific and admirable and heroic and perfect. Doesn't work that way.
Good point. And so moving in the last part of our interview now to a positive, do you yourself as the human being, David McCulloch, the human being, is there a particular moment that you describe in any of your books that proves as a personal inspiration to you in your work life?
Any particular moment in any of my books that provided inspiration?
That provides currently inspiration. You know, that you're reminded of an anecdote or an experience, for example.
Oh, constantly.
Tell me about one. Tell us about one.
Well, anytime I'm feeling down or beset by physical discomfort,
mm-hmm.
or problems with my loved ones, I think of people like Washington Roebling and what he suffered when he was leading the construction of the Brooklyn Bridge.
Mm-hmm.
I think of...
Tell us about that. Tell that story.
Well,
would you?
He was a man who suddenly had to take over this enormous responsibility, huge job, largest undertaking of its kind ever up until then. But when his father died, was killed by an accident in the early stages of the project. And in the course of the work, because he wouldn't ask any of his men to do what he himself wouldn't do, he went down into the caissons in the compressed air under the East River time and again and contracted what it was called then the caisson disease, which the bends, extremely painful, mm-hmm. and spent the last 10 years or so of the 14 years that it took to build the bridge in isolation, confined to his home in a house on Brooklyn Heights, where he watched over the project by use of field glasses and sent his wife back and forth to tell the people on the job what had to be done and so forth. But he was in terrible pain. Excruciating pain, and then he began to suffer psychological problems, and he was carrying the whole burden of this immense project, trying to deal at the same time with rampant political corruption and solving problems that nobody had to solve before because the engineering was so new and so unprecedented. And I take heart from him.
As well you should. You have one I love, I like looking at both the upsides and downsides of life. I like certainly to end on this up note. Is there some other story within your writings that you find particularly inspirational?
Oh, yes, indeed, sure. I find the story of St. Gaudens very inspirational in my current book. I find the story of Elizabeth Blackwell, the first woman to become American woman to become a physician.
Tell us about her a little bit.
And her experience in Paris, I find many of the people in my current book. I find Elihu Washburn, the American minister to Paris, who refused to leave when the Germans had the city surrounded during the Franco-Prussian War and were starving the city to death, and who kept the diary all the way through. I find him one of the most admirable and heroic characters I've ever encountered. And the fact that his name is not a household word doesn't in any way diminish his appeal to me. And writing his story, discovering his diary, was one of the most exhilarating experiences of my working life.
Tell me a little more about him, please.
Well, he was one of a big family. He grew up on a very hard scrabble farm in Maine. He went west and became an attorney in Illinois. Became a friend of another young attorney named Abraham Lincoln, and later went to Congress. Excuse me, where he served in the House during Lincoln's presidency, all the way through the Civil War, and was a great friend of Ulysses S. Grant. Was the one who really convinced Lincoln that Grant should be given command. And he was a heroic character, a strong abolitionist, tireless a worker. And then when he went to Paris, never imagining that he would be caught in the middle of a literal hell, he had to because of his sense of duty, remain there, and no other representative of any American power would do that.
Last question.
Any world power. He was the only one who stayed through the whole thing.
Last question. I want to, you know, you're always writing about somebody else. If you were to write your autobiography, what would be one key anecdote, one key decision, one key moment that you think might be illustrative to all of us in terms of our own work lives?
One key moment?
Yep, or dilemma or something, one key anecdote that you would tell in your autobiography.
Well, I met a wonderful old guy one time when I was just thinking about maybe becoming a writer. His name was Harry Drago, and he wrote pulp westerns. And I was told that he'd written over 100 books. And this was at a big reception in New York, and I saw him standing over up on the side, and I waited my chance, and I went over and I talked to him, and I said, "Mr. Drago, I'm told that you've written over 100 books." He said, "Yes, sir, that's right." I was about 25, and I said, "Sir, how do you do that?" He said, 4 pages a day. Best advice I ever got. If you want to write, get down and write, and keep at it every day. And I've never forgotten it, and I tip my hat to him every now and then, as I still try to do, at least 2 to 4 pages a day.
Well, David McCulloch, I'm glad that you didn't write hundreds of books, because they could never have been of the quality that books like The Greater Journey or Truman or John Adams or your books on the Panama Canal or the book on the Teddy Roosevelt or the book on the building of the Brooklyn Bridge. That was the second half of my interview with David McCulloch, a super biographer, hopefully with lots of lessons to be learned. Not easy to be brave. It is hard. I've gotten too old to just say be brave. Not quite so easy. Anyway, that is Work with Marty Nemco for this week. I want to thank my board operator, Joanne Marr, and of course, all of you for listening and calling in. Please join me again next Sunday at 11. I will do 3-minute career makeovers on callers, and in between those, the strategies my clients have found most useful in boosting their motivation. Until next Sunday, this is Marty Nemco reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.